I'm Joyce Slocum, President and CEO of Texas Public Radio. I want to welcome all of you to this presentation in TPR's Think Health Science series, which is produced and housed, I guess I would say, together with our good friends here at the University of Texas Health Science Center at San Antonio. I appreciate all of you braving the elements to be here this evening. I hope that the weather doesn't get bad before we get out of here. So I'm editing on the fly, I want you to know, because one of the things I'm supposed to do here is introduce my good friend, Dr. Bill Henrich. And I had his standard introduction ready, and he's told me I have only 2 seconds to introduce him, and I can't read that fast. So I'm just going to tell you that he is august and learned and a wonderful person, and he has been president of the UT Health Science Center since 2009. So please welcome Dr. Bill Henrich.
Well, good evening, everybody. It's a pleasure to welcome you to the Health Science Center campus and to the Pestana Lecture Hall for this installment of Think Health Science. I'm a great fan of Texas Public Radio and the public airway space, as many of you are, I know. And this is a community outreach event which we hold in great admiration. So thank you all for coming. I hope that the lecture and the information that you acquire here will be of great interest to you. I think it's known to everybody in the audience that there are rapid advances in biomedical science. It's a chance for me to give a small plug, maybe a large plug, to the general area of supporting biomedical research. The only hope that any of us have for brighter tomorrows, for ourselves, for our families, for our friends, our acquaintances, is that we continue to invest in biomedical research. As a country, as a community, it's the only way the ball gets advanced. Otherwise, we're left with what we have today. And in the case of these cancers, especially in the case of brain cancers, that's not far enough at all. We have a long, long way to go. And so in this regard, it's a pleasure to, at this session, welcome Dr. Andrew Brenner to the podium in a minute. Dr. Brenner is one of our esteemed faculty here at the Health Science Center. He's a neuro-oncologist. He has been educated at Texas A&M University. He got a PhD in neuroscience, tumor biology at MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. He received his medical degree from Texas Tech and then finished his training with a hematology-oncology fellowship here at the Health Science Center. Today, he's the leader of our neuro-oncology effort at the Cancer Therapy and Research Center, which is San Antonio's National Cancer Institute-designated center here in our region. And in this regard, he is pioneering new therapies in this dreadful disease of brain cancer. It's our prayer, our hope, earnest hope, that the trial he will tell you about tonight will prove successful or at least advance the ball in the therapy of these dreadful diseases. So it's a pleasure to welcome all of you here. I'm delighted all of you came, and I hope you'll tell your friends and colleagues about this series and that when they hear about it, they'll join you. The next time you come back, you'll always be welcome on the campus. Without further delay, please welcome Dr. Andrew Brenner.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here with you all. Hopefully everybody can hear me okay. I am also a lover of Texas Public Radio. There was once a time when I used to listen to nothing but music in my car. Now I find that it's almost constantly on TPR, listening to all the great knowledge I get through Texas Public Radio. So it's really an honor to be here with y'all tonight. So I'm going to talk a little bit about about clinical trials in general first, so that you have an idea when we talk about clinical trials, what we're talking about, and why they are so important. And then I'm going to give you an idea about brain tumors, and then talk about two clinical trials, one which we kind of heralded in our laboratory and is now entering into phase three, and then another one which was entirely developed here at the Health Science Center, which hopefully will also have a significant impact in terms of overcoming glioblastoma. So what are cancer clinical trials? Well, they are research studies involving people, and here's one of my patients who's on a clinical trial, James, who has been, after having progressed on conventional therapy on our gene therapeutic, one of the agents I'm going to talk about, and has been doing well for a number of years. And so these studies involve people and are for people, and they try to answer scientific questions, and the bottom line is to find better ways to either prevent, diagnose, or treat cancer. And why are they so important? Well, I think it's obvious to all of you because it's very likely that you have had somebody close to you that has been affected by cancer. Each year in the U.S., more than 500,000 people are expected to die of cancer, more than 1,500 people a day. And one in four deaths in the U.S. is from cancer. And more than 1 million new cancer cases are expected to be diagnosed each year. So, if you think, like, this is one of my patients here, Michelle was a dedicated person who showed up at our clinic to offer support and guidance for our patients that were diagnosed with brain tumors. And every Thursday, I'd see her in our consult room talking to patients who are newly diagnosed, and she was one of the most positive and upbeat persons. Unfortunately, Michelle lost her life to glioblastoma, and so we need to do more for people like her. Why are clinical trials important? Well, I think I mentioned that a little bit before, but they translate results of basic scientific research into better ways to prevent, diagnose, or treat cancer, as I mentioned. And the more people that take part, the faster we can answer critical research questions. And this is not just for cancer, but for a variety of different health conditions. And so we need to find better treatments and ways to prevent cancer. Do many people participate in cancer clinical trials? This is, I think, a very sad fact that only 3% of U.S. adults with cancer participate in clinical trials. And here's Tara Bibb, who's, I think, a model of a patient who progressed with glioblastoma after chemotherapy and radiation and went on to a clinical trial and has been now 5 years with that therapy and now no evidence of her tumor growing. And so if you think about all the people that do not participate in clinical trials, each one of them is a lost opportunity to answer an important question, but also help people, that clinical trials do help people. So types of cancer clinical trials, we have the treatment trials, which I'm going to talk about today, but there's also prevention trials. So there are a number of studies at the CTRC which involve even things like supplements like fish oil or using aspirin as a preventative or changing diet or exercise. There are early detection trials such as involving mammography for breast cancer or colonoscopy. There are lots of diagnostic trials and quality of life studies to help improve the lives of patients with cancer. So while only 3% participate, there are a very large number of opportunities for patients. There are multiple phases of clinical trials, and I'm going to use that term as we talk about the subsequent studies. Phase one trials are first time a drug is given to people or first time it's combined with another drug. So it can be either taking a drug that's FDA approved, but you have a brand new drug that you want to add to it and you're not sure about the safety of the combination, or it can be a drug that has never been given to a human ever before. It's going to be the first time that it's given. And we want to know, how does the agent affect the human body? Does it cause toxicity? We usually start very low and slowly work our way up so we don't put patients at risk. But we also are asking, how does the body affect the drug? We have different ways of administering drug by mouth or into a vein. By mouth, is it actually broken down in the stomach? Does it ever make it into the circulation? Is it cleared out by the kidneys or the liver? We want to know what dosage is safe, obviously, because before we look at a larger group of patients, we need to first define the appropriate dose. And we want to get those first signals if it works. Phase two is where you start to expand it. You know the dose, and you're going to give it to a larger group of patients, but but you're still looking to see a hint of that efficacy, to see really are we seeing some evidence that this should be studied in a larger group of patients and get that additional experience with safety. And then the phase 3 trials is where you take this new agent or intervention and you compare it to the standard. This is often where you see the term randomization. And randomization is where you take patients and they're either assigned, for example, to a standard of care or the standard of care plus something new, or if you're looking for something that might be better on its own, it could be the standard of care versus that new treatment. And it's important to note that placebos are almost never used in cancer treatment trials. We always, as doctors and scientists both, never want to put research before the patient. This is always a matter of treating the patient first. So possible benefits, well, patients will, as I mentioned, at minimum receive the standard treatment. And if the new treatment or intervention is proven to work, patients may be among the first to benefit from them. And patients have a chance to help others and improve cancer care. So why do so few cancer patients participate in clinical trials? Well, simply, a lot of patients don't know about clinical trials. Many might live in rural areas where they don't have ready access to clinical trials. Many might be afraid or suspicious of research where they feel like we're treating them as a guinea pig and we're going to expose them to something that might not be safe, or where there might be something better that they could receive as standard of care and that we're going to give them something inferior. And many think they can't afford to participate, that there's costs associated with the clinical trials. And in our therapeutic trials, that's not the case. And many don't want to go against their physician's wishes. They might go to a doctor, and a doctor says, you need drug A, and they don't want to go somewhere else where a clinical trial might be occurring or happening because they don't want that doctor who they've established a relationship to feel like they're not taking their advice. So if you're interested in more learning more about clinical trials, these are places you can go. You can look at our on the main page of the Health Science Center website. Under research, there's Find a Clinical Trial, ctrc.net. There's a link for clinical trials. And then the U.S. Website is clinicaltrials.gov, which will tell you about any clinical trial anywhere in this country. So let's talk about brain tumors a little bit. When people think about the brain, they mostly think of nerves, right? But there are a lot of other different cell types in the brain. And one of the more common cell types is that red star-shaped looking cell. And it's because it has that shape, it's called an astrocyte, as in star. And it has all these arms that reach out and do a lot of different things. That cell type is very important because it helps to guide nerves to make the appropriate connections. It helps to form the blood-brain barrier. It wraps its feet around the blood vessel and then helps to prevent anything that's not supposed to get across the blood vessel into the brain from getting there. It also can modify cause the blood vessels to get smaller or larger to regulate the blood flow. And it also is kind of the cleaning cell in the brain. It can actually ingest particles that are left behind and take care of any particles that are left from injury. There are also the oligodendrocytes, which I like to think of as the insulation on the wires. The nerves have to constantly fire back and forth. And it's like in your house, if you had exposed wires, what would happen? They would short circuit. Well, in the brain, it's very similar. And so we need these oligodendrocytes, which basically shoot out little arms and wrap them around the nerves to insulate them so that the impulse can get conducted without being lost along the way. And then we have these cells called the ependymal cells, which basically have these little tiny fingers that brush the spinal fluid, and they're on the surfaces of the brain, and as those fingers move in unison, they brush the fluid along to encourage circulation. There are a lot of different tumor types, almost all of them, or at least half, are of those types that I just basically mentioned, the glial tumors. Particularly, if you look at the numbers, the most common ones are the astrocytomas, those of that first cell type that I told you about, the astrocyte. And especially the highest grade, glioblastoma. Many years ago, they used to think there was a cell called the glioblast. There's no such thing, but the name stuck. Essentially, what it is the highest grade of an astrocytic tumor. There are four grades. The lowest grade, grade one, is called a pilocytic astrocytoma, usually found in little bitty kids, well circumscribed and can be removed. But all of the others tend to be diffuse and scattered throughout that area of the brain and cannot be easily or can be resected many times, but you always leave cells behind, so they always recur. We cannot surgically cure any of these tumors. And in fact, even if you have a grade 2, it eventually will progress in grade to grade 4 with astrocytomas. They're all grade 2 and grade 3 progress in grade to get more aggressive as time goes along. And so most of our development is towards glioblastoma because, number one, it's the most common type. It's the most aggressive. It's our biggest problem. And the lower grades of tumors will eventually turn into glioblastoma. And so there's a bit of a trickle-down effect. Whatever we develop for glioblastoma, we can often apply to other grades and cell types of brain tumors. So what are the challenges we face when we deal with glioblastoma? Well, one of them is simply, as I mentioned before, this thing called the blood-brain barrier. In order for things to get across into the brain, they have to traverse those blood vessel cells. And so anything that is in the blood vessel doesn't necessarily make it into the brain. And if it gets across just by its size or shape or any of its features, there are pumps that actually pump stuff right back into the blood once it gets across. So that's a major challenge for us, delivering drugs to the brain. Another issue is the invasiveness of these tumors. These cells, while you can see many all piled up here, they tend to kind of infiltrate through the brain, and you can see even distances from where the tumor resected, small little areas where the tumor is infiltrating. So this infiltrative nature of it is a big problem. And it's kind of, if you think about the normal function of these astrocytes, they have to be able to reach out over here and interact with those blood vessels and guide that nerve cell to make the appropriate connection. So by nature, even the non-cancerous cell type is infiltrative. So when you take that and turn it into a tumor, it becomes a very invasive tumor. And then another issue is the inherent resistance of this tumor type. You can see a patient here where they've had a tumor resected, but within a few centimeters of it, it just grew at the base of it and grew down further deeper. And so they tend to be resistant. So we have our hands full when we're dealing with them. Currently, glioblastoma, or grade 4 astrocytoma, is incurable. We want to change that. Patients only survive an average of 18 months. Now, those are averages, and every patient is a unique individual, and so we have patients that do much better than that, but unfortunately, they're not the majority, and hence 18 months is the average. And unfortunately, very little has changed in the last 50 years. We have not doubled survival by any means recently, and so we certainly need to try and do that. So in terms of things that we've been looking at in the lab, we've been trying to understand what might be the sensitivity of these tumors, what might be an area that they might be particularly prone to attack. And one of the features of these tumors is they're very vascular. They have lots of blood vessel cells. And what they do is they send out a particular hormone to cause growth of blood vessels to the tumor. And you see blood vessels throughout, but the blood vessels are not normal. This is in our animal models where we look directly in the tumor. And you can see that the blood vessels are very disorganized. Normally, you should see this nice, normal structure from larger to smaller, more like a honeycomb organization. But here, they're very kind of chaotic, and you even see these very large vessels in here. So we know for a long time, since the early 70s, that these tumors are very dependent upon blood vessel supply. And so there was a lot of hope that using these drugs called antiangiogenics, which basically block the development of new blood vessels, that we might be able to make a difference. However, we now have done multiple studies showing that the currently available anti-blood vessel therapies do not improve survival, really, and at best might delay onset of symptoms and slow down the tumor growth for most patients. So, and this is an example of what we see. We see two different patterns in terms of how patients do. We see this patient had this tumor right here, this white enhancing area. This is basically the gadolinium that's injected into the vein. And then it grows as if nothing ever happened, as if you didn't do anything. Sometimes we see it looks better, but if you wait and an image, doing a different type of image called a flare image, you see it's actually growing, but in a blood vessel independent way. It's learned how to grow despite that that inherent drop in the blood vessels. So when you think about that first case scenario, one thing we know is there are a lot of other growth factors than the ones we currently target that might be stimulating the growth of blood vessels. And about 8 years ago now, we started working with a compound called VB111. What it is a gene therapy that's delivered using a cold virus. The cold virus doesn't actually contain any virus DNA. It actually only contains a gene that was specifically designed and inserted into that viral package. And so it has two different features to it. One of them is that it gets delivered throughout the blood vessel system, but it has on it a promoter or an area that triggers the expression of the gene that only allows it to be expressed in blood vessel cells, and particularly in blood vessel cells that are actively trying to grow. And the protein that gets expressed is what we call a chimeric protein. It's two pieces of protein brought together. One of them is the tumor necrosis factor alpha receptor. You don't have to remember that, but what the important part about that is that particular protein receptor is found abundantly in the presence of tumor. On the inside of that, of the wall where that protein goes on the cell, is a cell death signal. So when this gene is expressed in blood vessel cells, it is triggered by the tumor, and that causes blood vessels only in the tumor to commit suicide so that the blood vessel should disappear. So, and this is basically another representation of it. You have the viral package delivering the gene. The gene gets expressed only in those blood vessel cells and especially in blood vessel cells that are trying to grow. A lot of this inflammatory marker from the tumor environment that turns on the gene that's produced, the protein that's produced as a result of that new gene, and it kills the endothelial cell to die. So we started testing it in our animal models because we thought this would be particularly attractive for glioblastoma based on what we know about glioblastoma and its dependence on blood vessel supply. And what we saw is we have the gene for the firefly, like you see them glow at night. Instead of the firefly having that protein, we put it into the tumor cells so that we can non-invasively take that mouse or rat and put it, have it sleeping inside of underneath the camera, and then it glows where the tumor is. And the amount that glows is directly correlated to the number of tumor cells that are there. So we can measure how big that tumor is or how little is. And what we see is that as soon as we give the gene therapy, we see a difference in the rate of growth. It immediately, within 1 week, affects that. And when we looked at the MRIs of the rats that we established the tumors in, what we saw is that in the control animals, by 2 weeks, half of the brain is filled with this tumor that we've established there. Whereas 2 weeks in the treatment animals, you see kind of just a little hole there where the tumor is barely able to grow. So it's basically kind of died from the inside there. And so when we looked at the animals, how they were surviving, we noticed just with one single treatment, their survival was increased by a median of approximately 30%. So it was pretty significant. And so then we were going into our phase 1 clinical trial, and I mentioned that before. This is the first time it's given to humans. That's not in brain tumor patients necessarily. Sometimes the first time you do it is just in any type of cancer, all cancers. And so we started going with increasing a number of viral particles and kept going up. And really what we found is that when we gave this, there weren't a lot of symptoms. You see not a lot of numbers here in the total in terms of any serious toxicities, which would be grade 3 or above, and even in the minor toxicities, grade 1 and 2, which are really considered very tolerable levels of toxicity, the numbers were very low. Despite treating 33 patients, only a fraction had any significant side effects, and the majority was this fever. And this fever occurred about 6 hours after we gave the gene therapy, and then the next morning, it was gone. And usually controlled with either ibuprofen or Tylenol, so very well tolerated. And what we saw is even in these patients with all different types of cancers, when we looked at the rate of growth in the first few cohorts where we weren't really giving very much and we knew we had to start somewhere and work our way up, But it really wasn't doing much, and the tumors were, generally speaking, still growing. We saw some that were stabilized out. But when we got up into the higher doses, we saw not only patients' tumors stabilizing, but some that significantly decreased. And what we saw is that the survival in patients on the highest levels of the gene therapy was significantly better than on the lower doses of that gene therapy. So a good signal that it might have efficacy for our patients. We then designed a clinical trial specific for glioblastoma patients. We often do these dual phase studies because we have to take a step back because we're now studying in brain tumor patients who have never received this drug before. So we lower the dose a few levels and then work our way back up. And in this particular case, we then later designed another arm where patients who normally would get this drug, this gene therapy called VB111, and then would go on to Avastin, we allowed them to keep getting this drug even after and even when they went, when it started to grow and went on to Avastin, and I'll explain that in just a minute. In any case, in the 62 patients with recurrent glioblastoma that we treated, and I have to mention, while we initiated the trial here and did all the preclinical work here, it was also opened up at Dana-Farber and in Tel Aviv and at Duke, and so they also contributed to the study, although I think we did most of the work. And in any case, of the 62 patients we treated, very little in the way of toxicity. The main thing we saw, again, was the febrile reaction, which resolved by the next day. And we saw some very significant evidence of response. This is one of my patients here who had this temporal lesion here. This is the side of head, top of the head, and this is the brain. And you can see this white circular lesion there. And then with treatment alone on VB111, it disappeared. And there was a little bit of enhancement left, not completely disappeared. This is another one of our patients. This is one of our veterans who had been diagnosed with GBM and did very well for a significant amount of time, but then his tumor recurred, and this is what it looked like. And we put him on VB111 by itself, and slowly over time, it started to disappear. But you'll notice something, that there was a lag in how long it took for this to take effect. And glioblastoma is a very rapid-acting tumor. So that's why we designed that second arm of the study where we could allow patients to go ahead and receive Avastin if there was some growth. And mainly what we were looking at was survival as an endpoint, not the rate of growth. And here's another case right here. This patient has been on VB111. I showed you his picture earlier and is doing... very well, no evidence of tumor right now. And this basically shows how much growth or shrinkage each of the individual patients had. And each bar is an individual patient. And what you see is when the patients only received a limited VB111, not much in the way of shrinkage. We had some shrinkage, a couple cases, but when we combined it with Avastin, we saw significant higher number of responses. And then when we looked at survival, we found that the patients who received continuous dosing with VB111 were living significantly longer. As a matter of fact, the median survival for the combination of this VB111 together with Avastin was 15 months, whereas in the group that only received a limited dose and then went on to directly to Avastin with no further VB111 only survived 8 months. So nearly a doubling in survival with VB111. And this is to compare the results we saw with results from other studies. All of these are studies of Avastin by itself, and you can see it beat this particular phase 2 study beat all of those other studies and was statistically significant, highly statistically significant for the four studies pooled compared to our treatment here. And then another interesting thing we saw is in those patients who had the fever, those appeared to be living the longest, is something that we observed in the clinic. So we went back and looked at all the centers, and in fact, that's what we saw. The patients who had the febrile response were indeed living the longest. So we are now investigating whether our gene therapy might be doing more than just killing the blood vessel cells, but also activating the immune system, because when you kill those blood vessel cells and you're expressing this new protein on the surface, you could be exposing the immune system to a new protein and to abundant blood vessel cells, and that could, in fact, activate the tumor immune cells. So in summary, VB111 uses a cold viral particle to deliver a gene to blood vessel cells. It specifically instructs those cells supplying the tumor to die. Very well tolerated, only given once every 8 weeks. I don't know if I mentioned that. Because it's a gene therapy, people don't have to take pills every day. They don't have to get chemo infusions into the bloodstream. This is given once every 8 weeks and with very good tolerance. And we saw that it nearly doubled survival compared to Avastin alone. This is currently in a randomized controlled study in 54 institutions across the country. And we hope that that will continue to see the survival advantage and it will be FDA approved and that we'll have this available to our patients. Okay, so now I'm going to move on and talk about the radiotherapy that we're developing. So to take a step back, we've been using radiotherapy since the late 50s, early 60s. And the reality is our radiation techniques have improved over the years. And if you look at how patients did, if you did just give them the best supportive care, this is this line here. And 100 means all of them are alive, 0 means that they've all passed away. Okay? And these are months down here. And you can see that on average, they only lived, if you gave them best supportive care, about 4-5 months, which was not very good. Then we started using radiation, and we saw it doubled survival. But doubling survival from 4 to 8 months is not that great of an accomplishment. We started changing our methods of radiotherapy. We now are able to use things like tomotherapy, where it's like a CT scanner, and it spins around the patient. And as it spins around the patient, it opens and closes shutters so it can deliver what we call conformal or three-dimensional radiation. And that's helped some, because if you can kind of shape the radiation, you can avoid exposure of the normal brain to toxicity from the radiation. And so we, over the years, have gotten better, and patients are now living even longer and beyond 12 months. And we've seen this drift where when we take everything combined, radiation, chemotherapy, et cetera, the median or average survival is around 16 to 18 months. Of that, radiation made the most difference. Very clearly, it is the one that made the most difference. I hate to say that because as an oncologist, well, we give chemotherapy, and so we haven't really made the most difference. So I would like to be able to take credit for our group, but really the radiation oncologist made the most difference for glioblastoma, and we're struggling to make a difference. But why can't we do more? What's the limitation of giving radiation? Why not just double the amount we give? And it's really a simple concept. When that machine is spinning around, even though it's opening and closing shutters, those beams have to pass through normal brain to get to the tumor. And so that part of the brain is being exposed to these radiation beams. And even though we use very three-dimensional techniques to administer it, it still is going through the normal brain. And so we've tried lots of different ways, and even with the most recent studies, we've maybe been able to increase the dose we give by about 25%. To around 80 gray. So the standard right now in this country is 60 gray. And that's just, you don't have to know what gray is, but it's the amount of radiation absorbed by the tumor. And if you try and go above 80 gray, you start experiencing toxicity from the exposure of the normal brain. But what if we change the way we give it? For prostate cancer, they insert pellets or seeds into the prostate. And you can give a significant amount there, but you have to give hundreds of seeds, and it's really not very feasible to be injecting throughout the brain. Okay, it's just not realistic. With the thyroid gland, you could give radioactive iodine, and they give massive amounts of that. But because the thyroid gland just sucks up iodine, right? We're all eating iodine in our salt. We need it, and our thyroid gland uses it. So it just takes that all up. So it's all getting held right there in the thyroid, but not getting exposed to the brain or the heart or the lungs or the liver, right? And with that, they can give tremendous amounts. And so we have very successful therapy for thyroid cancer. So can we do something similar in the brain? Well, we think we can. And that's where the rhenium nanoliposomes come in. That was developed, the bottom line of what nanoliposomes are is they're very similar to a cell. They're like a fat bubble. Our cells all are basically little bags of water, to take a quote from Star Trek, right? But they're bags of water, and the fat that makes up the membrane is what keeps that water confined and makes all the different things like the nucleus and the ribosome, not the ribosomes, but the endoplasmic reticulum and things like that, all these different structures within the cells, everything is held in place by these fatty molecules called lipids. Well, this is basically a lipid bubble, but it's 1/1,000th the size of a cell. And we've been using liposomes for chemotherapy for a number of years. We have drugs like Doxil, which many people have heard of for a variety of different cancers, and is just liposomally encapsulated doxorubicin, which is an old drug that's been around for years. And so we have liposomal encapsulation, and it changes the way that chemotherapies work. It reduces the toxicity. We can give much more of liposomal doxorubicin than we can regular doxorubicin, because when you try and give too much doxorubicin, it damages the heart. And so we have these means of encapsulating these chemotherapies, and they make chemotherapies better. But nobody's really found a way of, with a high degree of specificity, trapping radiation within these liposomes until our group here of Andy Bao, Beth Goins, and Bill Phillips, who figured out what a trick was. And it's really a very simple trick. But the bottom line is you can get lots of this radiation particle called rhenium into these liposomes. And this particular radiation particle, these rhenium molecules, they are much different than the radiation that's given with the beam. The radiation itself only has enough energy to travel about 2 millimeters. So you're talking a very, very small amount, one eighth or less of an inch. So really where it's retained is where the radiation is absorbed. And so it's ideal in that sense in terms of what we were talking about before. Another very important aspect of this particular radioisotope is, well, it gives off these particles called beta emissions that are the ones that are absorbed by the tissue. It also gives off every now and then one that called a gamma emission that could be detected by a instrument, and we use these instruments all the time. And so we can actually see it being given, not just have to guess where it's being given. And so this is the trick of how they got it in there. Here's the molecule. It's this long, lots of carbons there, and so without it having any exposure to a different pH, it is able to just make its way through that lipid bubble. And it traps that rhenium right in the middle, and it moves across. When it gets into the lipid bubble, the pH changes, and all of a sudden it has charges, and those charges prevent it from making its way back across. So it's stuck in there for good once it gets in there. And this is to show you why liposomal encapsulation is important. If you just take rhenium by itself with the radioisotope and you inject it into a tumor, what you see is it just rapidly goes away. It's because it's a small molecule. If you inject many things into tissues, they just get picked up by the bloodstream, they get taken to the kidneys or the liver, and they get excreted. And what we want is we want the radiation to be retained. And when you put it in the liposome, it stays there for a good amount of time. And it actually does better than this, and I'll show you the data that we have. Another reason you want these liposomes is because you want to distribute it. We do something called convection, which is you're applying pressure. And when you apply that pressure, it causes the drug to move out. Well, one aspect of that is the size of the particle. Smaller particles do not convect the same way larger molecules do. So when you have these liposomes, they spread better through the tissue. So you can apply that pressure and get them to deliver farther out. And that's what you see here, is it's being delivered better than if we injected it without the liposomes. So then we went to our animal models, very similar to what I showed you before, and we started treating them. And so we honestly didn't really have a lot of ideas what to expect. We thought, well, maybe we'll get up to like 80 or 100 gray, and then after that, we're going to start seeing some toxicity. But we just kept going, and we weren't seeing toxicity. And in one experiment, we went all the way up to 1,800 gray. So a reminder of what I was talking about before. With external beams, the standard in this country is 60 gray. We achieved in these animals 1,800 gray, 30 times the amount of radiation at once absorbed by that tissue. And the only animal that we lost one right here because he had a skin infection. It had nothing to do with the tumor or anything we were doing. So we then went on and we treated more rats. And here, these have a more aggressive tumor type than the one we have here. And we treated them all with the highest doses. And what we found is that they were all living just fine and doing very well. And in fact, when we looked at the MRIs, this is very similar to what I showed you before. You can see the white area here. This is the tumor one day before any treatment. Here we just injected empty liposomes. And after 2 weeks, almost half the brain is filled up here with tumor. When we treated with the liposomes, nothing gone. And we didn't see any evidence of tumor there. As a matter of fact, we have the same physician that diagnoses under the microscope for us, the neuropathologist, Dr. Henry, who does that for us with our patients, looked at the brains of the rats, and he says, well, all I see is holes. If there's a tumor here, I'll have to take your word for it, but I don't see it. So that was also another good outcome there. So we had this very exciting therapeutic that we thought, wow, this would be great if we could give it to our patients, but it's one thing to treat rats. It's another thing to treat humans. So our team, Dr. Floyd, Beth Goins, who was generating the RNL for us, and I would make these trips every week up to a place called Mattawan, Michigan. And it was one of the few facilities in the country that could do these preclinical studies, these toxicology studies, in a way that the FDA approves of. Because everything has to be measured and recorded in order to be reviewed by the FDA. Every day, the weight of the animal, how much they eat, how much they drink, the machine you used, when it was last calibrated, every little thing has to be reviewed. And we were working with radiation, which made a lot of people nervous. So we made the trip up there every week, and we did the studies. You can see Dr. Floyd and I, and we're in the operating room, and this is a dog, and we are injecting into the brain using the same catheter that we were going to be using in the clinical trials to inject it. And we did this. And the bottom line is that we gave six times our anticipated starting dose, or 360 gray, and all they could see was the place where the catheter was. There was really no evidence of any injury from the therapeutic itself, from the RNL. Then we had to do something else. So we could prove to the FDA that, in fact, this appeared to be safe, but the FDA also wants you to prove to them that what you're making is what you say you're making and that your methods for making it are, in fact, reliable. So we entered into collaboration with the National Cancer Institute's Nanotechnology Characterization Laboratory. And I'll tell you, this place is beautiful. They've got every gadget under the sun. That's where your tax dollars are going. But in this case, it helped us tremendously. And so we provided them with some of our labeled nanoliposomes, and we also gave them the methods to make them. And so they went back, and they made them, and they compared them to what we made, and basically found that it was exactly the same. First of all, almost 100% of the rhenium that we're trying to get into those liposomes was in those liposomes. Further, you could leave it on top of the bench for a couple of weeks and come back, and there was still 99% in those liposomes. It didn't go anywhere. And the size and everything we were using was what we said we were using. So the FDA then allowed us to move forward. We did have another problem, though. It's one thing to inject into a rat brain. It's another thing to deliver to a human. And so we had entered into collaboration with a company called Brainlab. Brainlab is well known by neurosurgeons, but probably nobody else in this room knows about them. But what Brainlab does is they have what we call neuronavigation equipment. And so when you go to get an MRI, the neurosurgeon can load it up in the operating room, and he knows exactly where he is when he's doing the surgery. He can take a pointer and point it on the base of the tumor, and it shows him exactly on the MRI where the tip of that is. So Brainlab had been developing a catheter with a similar type of system where you could know exactly where it was in space and on the patient's imaging. And it had not been used in humans before, and they needed an application for it. And this was a special one that could be implanted and left in the patient. The patient could leave the operating room with that in place and then just pull that later. So we entered into collaboration with them, and here you can see an example of a patient, and this is where you plan to put it, and the machine guiding you to it, and then here's a 3D representation reconstruction from the program. And this is the catheter itself, and there's a system you basically can scan the patient's forehead, or you can merge a CT, and it will inform the system of where the patient is on the operating table. So we had our system in place, and we were ready to go. It was a lot to get there, as you can imagine. And this is our first patient. And you can see, very similar to the other images I showed you, here's an MRI. This is called a sagittal view. Forehead, eye, back of the head. It's a little bit dark, I'm sorry. Top of the head. This is the cavity where the tumor was resected previously. This is the tumor right above it. So what we did is we take that MRI and we load it into the system. We can highlight any structure, such as the optic track, and the system will take those images and use it to track those fibers wherever they go in the brain. In this case, we were worried about this patient's visual fields, and so we highlighted the optic chiasm where the nerves from the eyes come back before they enter the brain, and it showed us where they were going back here so we could make sure not to injure it. We could highlight the area where the tumor was resected previously to try and avoid that so that our drug didn't just spill into an open cavity. We could highlight the tumor itself, and then we could highlight the swelling that was resulting from the tumor. And then Dr. Floyd and I would take a look and decide where we're going to place this catheter, such that we make sure that the tip of the catheter is embedded far enough that there's no leakage backwards along the catheter, because remember, we're applying pressure. And so that we could run a simulation, push a button, and it tells us that it's getting us good coverage. Then we get into the OR, and here's Dr. Floyd and our first patient, and the hole that's made into the skull is about 3 millimeters, so between the size of a pen and a pen tip, very small burr hole, and the incision was about a half inch. And then we insert the catheter into the spot using the navigation system. You can see up here is it's showing us the patient and where we are in three planes. And this particular device here, we set it, and it guides us so we can't make a mistake with our trajectory. And then the patient wakes up, and they got a little bump sticking out of his head and a little catheter with a tube coming out. And then we take them to the nuclear medicine suite. We hook up to a catheter. We run the rhenium nanoliposomes in, and you can see here what we observed. So this is our first patient. I showed you the tumor before, and the sagittal image is up here. And you can see the lines of coverage of the drug. So this is direct imaging of the drug because of that gamma emission that I mentioned. We can detect it with a SPECT CT machine. And so we see the drug over the tumor, and very good coverage here. And this is 120 hours out. This is 5 days later, and you can see it's very well retained there. We can get, in some of the cases that we've done, as much as 99% is retained within the tumor. Almost none is absorbed by the body. So far, we've treated 5 patients to date. We've achieved up to 5 times the standard dose. You have to remember, when we start these studies, we have to start low and work our way up. And despite starting at very low dose and only aiming to achieve around 30 to 60 gray, we actually achieved nearly 300 gray. So because the retention was just that good. No evidence of toxicity observed out to 9 months. Patients experienced only minor discomfort. Normally, patients for radiation have to go daily, Monday through Friday, for 6 weeks to get the 60 gray that's prescribed. So 30 times have to go back and forth. This was administered all within a few hours and was 5 times the dose. We saw a good spread of the rhenium nanoliposomes of the tumors over 5 days. We did not see any radioactivity in any of their organs, and so we're continuing to increase the dose until we reach the safest and most effective dose. So I'll stop there. I know I've talked a lot, and it's important to thank our patients, not just on the VB111 and RNL studies, but we do a lot of research trying to change the outcomes of this disease as well as many other diseases. And without our patients, we couldn't go anywhere with this. And then all of our collaborators, both here at the Health Science Center and at other places. Thank you.
Thank you. That's amazing work going on. Thank you so much. We have a little bit of time for questions. We have mics on each of the stairways. If you can easily make your way to a mic, please do that. If you would have a little trouble getting there, raise your hand and one of these nice people will bring you a mic. You have questions for Dr. Brenner? Okay, let's start over here then.
Yes, ma'am.
Dr. Brenner, thank you. I don't have a question. My mom passed at 56 from a glioblastoma. That was 16 years ago. She did take part in a clinical trial, and at that time it was using the chemo before the radiation. And then because of the toxicity of the radiation, she didn't make it all the way through. She decided halfway through to stop for her quality of life. And so I just want to say thank you. This is so exciting. Besides losing my mom, I had a friend that lost his father, and so this just seems really important, and it's a very exciting discovery, so thank you so much.
Well, thank you, and I'm very sorry for what you had to go through as well as what your mom had to go through. And while a lot of people, while it seems that brain tumors are less common than many other tumors, I can't tell you how many people come up to me and tell me about their loved ones who had to suffer from a brain tumor. And another thing that maybe I didn't mention, but the bad thing about brain tumors isn't just that people lose their lives, but they can affect who a person is, and it's very hard for the family as caregivers to see that person change. And so so we have some very brave patients, some very brave families, and families are very important in this disease, and we'll keep fighting.
If you mentioned it, I apologize, but how is the radiation actually released from the liposome?
So that's the good thing, is it really doesn't have to be. Now, there are a couple different cell types that can engulf them, and one of them is a cell very related to the macrophages, which are responsible for cleaning up any injury, and it's called the microglia, which are of the same lineage, but when they get in the brain, they're different. And so those cells are present around, and wherever there's inflammation or wounds, these microglia are around, and so they can gobble these up, and they get filled with them. And because they're no longer dividing, they're more resistant to the radiation. They can handle it for much longer than the tumor cells can. And so we think that they are able to pick them up and kind of move around in the tumor, and that might be why we see some kind of movement between when we finish the infusion and 5 days later. So it can just sit within the cell, and those particles are being shot off, and they travel 2 millimeters. So they are directly from the inside of the cell, not just passing through that cell and damaging its DNA, but those particles can travel about 1,000 cells around and hit the other cells around them. Yes, sir.
You need 30 patients to complete the trial. Does
yes, sir.
It matter where they are? Do they have to be here, Boston or Israel, or can they be in California, say?
Well, that's the beautiful thing about this particular study, is because we do the treatment all at once, they can come from anywhere around the country. And a matter of fact, we could help them with transportation to get here. It's just a matter of finding, number one, the right patients. Because of the way we designed, safety is always foremost when it comes to clinical trials. And so when we design the study, we design it with increasing amounts of the radioactivity that we give and increasing volumes. So we have to start with smaller tumors. You'll notice our first patient, the tumor was only about the size of a quarter. If we administered the same amount of radiation and tried to treat somebody with a softball-sized tumor, we would just be treating a part of the tumor, and it would be without any beneficence. There would be no potential benefit to that patient. So we have to be very selective, and we will keep increasing the amounts. As we increase the amounts, we'll be able to take patients with larger and larger tumors. But right now, we're kind of in this little bit of conundrum where we have to go slow because we have to be very careful of the size. So we would very much welcome patients from anywhere in the country or even internationally. And we have had patients reach out to us from California, Germany, lots of places. But unfortunately, a lot of those patients are patients who are much farther along in the disease, have much larger volumes, and that makes it very difficult.
Any other questions? All right, let's thank Dr. Brenner again, and thank you all for coming. Be careful on the wet roads going home, please.